Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 37, The Nature of Colonialism. What is the nature of colonialism? What does it mean to be a colonized country? What does it mean to act in a colonial manner? Can we both be part of an independent country and yet still be oppressed as if we're colonized? As we head into the final stretch of this podcast, keep in mind that it is the struggle over this question which drove forward the events of Singapore's decolonization. It is one that I'll be asking again and again. It hung over all the events in this period. It was in the minds of all the people of Singapore, and particularly of their leaders, as we moved towards Singapore's independence. So keep it in mind as we move forward towards the end of this podcast. Now, picking up where we left off last week, as the People's Action Party's first year in power came to a close in May 1960, they were riding high. They had won plaudits, made important improvements to Singapore. They were popular. One year later, they were absolutely crushed, destroyed in a crucial by-election, which party leader Lee Kuan Yew had declared to be a referendum on his government, and by extension, a referendum on his leadership. What happened? Well, over the course of the PAP's second year in power, the party leadership lost the support of many of their party members and saw a steep decline in their support among the public. In our last episode, I mentioned how the arrogance and high-handedness of the PAP leadership and their treatment of their colleagues with contempt and condescension, their refusal to operate using the normal established channels of government, and indeed their steady undermining of the independence of a lot of agencies of government and the sharp increase in arbitrary executive power, and their refusal to consult people who knew more about the subject than they did. All this angered and infuriated the members of the PAP. But more about that next week. This week, I will focus on the fundamental issue, the issue that angered the party's left wing the most, the issue which would drive the PAP split, and by extension, all the dramatic events of 1961 to 63, the by-elections, the formation of the Barisan, our only national referendum, Operation Cold Store, merger, and even separation. The issue is detention without trial. And more fundamentally, the significance of detention without trial as to the status, the rights of the people of Singapore. In short, it boils down to a simple question, simple to ask, but incredibly difficult to answer. What is the nature of colonialism? If an unelected organization in Singapore can arrest and detain without trial and torture with no oversight, no accountability, no appeal against the wishes of a locally elected government, then aren't we still a colonial country? If they can do this against the will of the people, aren't we still a colonial country? And if a leader perpetuates the ability of this unelected organization to detain and torture Singapore citizens without trial, then isn't he an agent of colonialism? You see, with the introduction of Singapore's new constitution in 1959, we became internally self-governing, but with one crucial exception, the Internal Security Council. Among other things, the Internal Security Council had the power to order the arrest and detention without trial of anyone in Singapore. You could not appeal its decisions. It was basically a law unto itself, a mini unelected government whose powers could overrule the elected representatives of Singapore. The Internal Security Council was formed of 7 members, 3 representatives of the Singapore government, 3 representatives of the British government, and 1 representative of the Federation of Malaya. In practice, this usually meant that the 7 people in attendance would be Lee Kuan Yew, Goh Keng Swee, and Ong Pang Boon from Singapore, And from the Federation of Malaya, the great Tun Dr. Ismail, the Internal Security Minister. Well, back then he was just Dato Ismail. But Tun Ismail is the greatest prime minister that Malaysia never had. There's another great what if in Malayan history. What if Ismail hadn't died suddenly in 1973? He would have been the third prime minister, not Hussein On. And I think Malaysia would be much better for it today. Of Malaysia's great heroes of Merdeka, Tun Ismail stands only behind Tunku Abdul Rahman and Tun Abdul Razak. His sudden death was such a huge loss. But anyway, I digress. So of the seven, we have three Singaporeans, one Federation of Malaya, and three British representatives, who were the general officer commanding the British troops in Singapore. In this period, it was Major General Williams, the Deputy Commissioner of the UK government, Philip Moore, and the Chairman of the Council was the British Commissioner. For the first 6 months, from June to December 1959, this was William Good. But he was moved on to become Governor of Sabah, of North Borneo. And after that, it was the Earl of Selkirk, the great war hero and former cabinet minister, who was sent to Singapore specifically as a safe, reliable pair of hands to handle the delicate Singapore situation. Also present were various advisors like the directors of Special Branch for Singapore and for the Federation, the Commissioner of Police, the Attorney General, the MI5 representative in Singapore, and so on and so forth, AIDS Secretary, so on and so forth. Now, in the negotiations for Singapore's new constitution back in 57, the British had initially been happy to make this council purely advisory. But Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew asked for its decisions to be binding. This would allow them to secretly use the British and Federation as cover for their own oppression. It would enable them to carry out oppression in Singapore while blaming the British and the Federation governments for forcing them to carry out the oppression. The deliberations within the Internal Security Council would be secret and would only be revealed to the world 50 years later when the British documents were finally declassified, so nobody would know. Now, previously, of course, detention without trial was introduced into Singapore as part of the declaration of the Malayan Emergency in 1948. The threat of communism was used to justify a complete suspension of the law and of due process. Communism, said the British, was a deadly threat to Malaya's existence. Now, in previous episodes, I've discussed the veracity and validity of that argument. Whether it is true or not that communism was a threat is something that I won't get back into. Again, you can listen to previous episodes. What's important to understand today is that under the emergency regulations, the government could arrest and lock up anyone without trial, torture and beat them, and even deport them back to the country of their birth. The problem was that as the threat of communism ebbed, the suspension of the law remained. Now, again, in previous episodes, I have described how, from around 1952, Singapore's Special Branch could not find evidence of communist conspiracy in Singapore. And as their own records and history has proven, there was no conspiracy. There were individual communists, there were a few diehards, and also Yew Choy Yip hiding in the jungle and printing Freedom News, but staying out of the fray. But Special Branch remained convinced that terrorism remained out there, and politicians used this to justify the continued suspension of the law and of due process and of the rights of citizens. And the British colonial administrators were eager to use this to justify their suspensions of rights and due process. As I've mentioned before, from 1949 onwards, the colonial administration embarked on massive social engineering to cut us off from our own culture and impose an English-speaking British culture on us in an attempt to turn us into loyal British subjects, so that once we decolonized politically, we would still think and act and identify with Britain. To completely destroy a people's culture, you need to destroy their history, their books, their art, their language, and cut them off from their past. To do this, you need to use the most draconian methods. Qin Shi Huang burned the books and murdered the intellectuals. Pol Pot burned the books and murdered the intellectuals. Mao's Red Guards burned the books and murdered the intellectuals. And the British were only slightly more sophisticated. They banned the books and locked up the intellectuals. They accused them of being communists and locked them up without trial. Now, as I record this, the Chilcot Report into Iraq has just been released. The report is highly critical of MI6's collection and presentation of its sources, of the analysis by the wider intelligence community, of the way the Joint Intelligence Committee in the UK allowed its material to be used, and of the way in which politicians talked about intelligence to the public. One specific conclusion of the report is that policy on the Iraq invasion was made on the basis of flawed intelligence assessments. It relied too heavily on speculative and even made-up evidence from a single source. This source was not challenged and should have been. And the head of MI6 was too cozy of politicians and too eager to deliver on what they wanted to hear. As the Chilcot Report noted, and I quote here, "Sir Richard Dearlove's personal intervention and its urgency gave added weight to a report that had not been properly evaluated and would have coloured the perception of ministers and senior officials. The report should have been treated with caution." And this parallels with what happened with Singapore in the 1950s. Singapore's colonial administrators needed to hear that the colony was still rife with communism. Lim Yew Hock wanted to hear that it was still rife with communism, so that they could justify locking up people without trial, locking up anyone who got in their way, locking up anyone who stopped them from destroying the language and culture and identity of Singapore's people. At the same time, of course, opposition politicians attacked Singapore's British colonial government for detaining people without trial. In particular, Lee Kuan Yew attacked the colonial government for locking up his colleagues in the People's Action Party. He had repeatedly made strong, unequivocal condemnations of detention without trial. It was held up as an example of the repression that epitomized colonialism, and he accompanied it with a demand for independence and hints that such abuses of human rights would be ended by a locally elected government that was responsible to Singaporeans, or more specifically, by his government. Now, in that sense, Lee Kuan Yew's position was not so different from Lim Chin Siong's or from David Marshall's. All of them basically agreed that detention without trial was not in and of itself a bad thing. But it had been so badly abused by the government. What it needed was oversight and accountability. All of them agreed publicly that if such a law was passed by a democratically elected government, then there were oversights and checks and balances. That a government which used such a law would then have to face the judgment of the people via elections? Well, that was how a democratic system worked. If a government uses detention without trial, then submits itself to the judgment of the voting public and wins a free and fair election, well then, it's fair enough. And when David Marshall's government passed the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance in 1955, he did exactly this. He passed a law through the process of government and he defended it. Publicly, he reminded Singaporeans that independent countries, such as India, for example, also used detention without trial. The important thing was that there was oversight and accountability from those who exercise such powers. And David Marshall sought to exercise this responsibility to the utmost. The key difference, of course, between Lee Kuan Yew and David Marshall and Lim Chin Siong was a moral one, was a legalistic one. That will come as no surprise to regular listeners of this podcast. Marshall stood up for justice. He never ordered anyone to be locked up. And when the British locked up people against his wishes, he sought to have them put on trial as soon as possible. Lim Chin Siong, likewise, meant what he said and stuck to that position throughout his abbreviated political career. He said if he locked up people without trial, he would then take responsibility for it and go to the people and explain why he did it for the common good. But Lee Kuan Yew, of course, interpreted take responsibility in a different way. He interpreted it as avoid responsibility. He observed the letter but not the spirit of that position. He did not want to take responsibility for locking people up without trial because he knew it was unpopular. But like the British in Lim Yew Hong, Lee also wanted to use detention without trial. He wanted to lock up his enemies and keep them locked up. But he knew that it was extremely unpopular, that it was associated with colonialism. And then after Lim Yew Hong did it, his popularity steeply declined and he lost the 1959 election, underscoring the message to Lee Kuan Yew that he had to avoid responsibility for detention without trial at all costs. The ability to arbitrarily destroy people's lives by slavery, by torture, by locking them up without trial, by a government unaccountable to the people, those are the hallmarks of colonialism. But from Lee's perspective, if he could lock up people while avoiding responsibility, well, that's fine, that's so much the better. He had no moral issue with destroying people's lives. To him, it was a political issue. Can I destroy lives while ensuring that I get no blame? Or better yet, someone else takes the blame? If so, that's okay. And that's what Lee Kuan Yew set out to do. And when we return, we examine the events of 1960 to 61 and how the issue of detention without trial drove the split of the PAP. Stay tuned. Welcome back. For the people of Singapore, following the events of the Malayan Emergency and the crackdowns of the 1950s, no policy came to epitomize colonialism as much as detention without trial. It is dehumanizing to have your freedom taken away for no reason, to be tortured by being placed in solitary confinement, by being beaten and starved, by being denied sleep until you hallucinate, not allowed to go to the toilet, by being repeatedly humiliated and taunted and verbally abused, by being exposed to extreme cold and heat. These were all the tactics of the Nazi Gestapo, of Stalin's gulags, of the Chinese communists, and of course, of the British in Malaya, in Kenya, in Uganda, in Northern Ireland. These are all classified as torture by the United Nations. Knowing how hated detention without trial was, Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP in 1959 campaigned on a platform that promised the release of political detainees as a precondition for the PAP taking power. But as we detailed last week, Lee did not want to release any detainees at all, and only released the first six out of necessity. He did not care what happened to them on the inside. All he cared about was that they were not free to challenge his power. Lee made extensive plans to make sure that he released only a bare minimum of the detainees, and that those he did have to release would be neutralized or controlled, that those released would have no influence on his party. At the time, Lee publicly promised that all detainees would be released within 3 to 6 months. After an initial burst of releases, detainees were released in progressively smaller batches at progressively larger intervals. By early 1960, releases had come to a halt. Very understandably, many of Lee's colleagues in the PAP were angry about this, especially those who had just been released from detention. They knew from personal experience how horrible, how dehumanizing, how evil it was to lock away a man or a woman for no reason. They knew how much it was to suffer in detention, but Lee disappointed them all. Lee, of course, sought to avoid responsibility for not releasing the other detainees. Publicly, he condemned the continued detentions. He blamed the Internal Security Council for blocking his attempts to release the detainees. But of course, privately, in the Internal Security Council, he urged the British to arrest and detain his colleagues. He used the Internal Security Council to privately push for continued detention. He was very conscious of the need to appear that he was making an attempt to obtain releases. And so he also covered his tracks. In August 1959, he tabled a document in the Internal Security Council calling for the release of the detainees, then, at the next meeting of the Internal Security Council, asked them to veto the document to vote it down on his behalf so that his government would not have to, quote, soil their hands, unquote. This would then allow him, in the future, to present the document as evidence that he had tried to obtain the release of the detainees, and then he could say it was vetoed by the ISC. He would, of course, not bother to mention that he was the one who had asked the ISC to veto the document. Spoiler alert, he would eventually play this trump card in July 1961. But in the meantime, publicly, he continued to blame the Internal Security Council for forcing him to keep the detainees in, or for delaying the release of detainees. And he excoriated the British and Federation governments for forcing him to do so. So, Lee is not just a hypocrite. He's an extremely clever, very deliberate hypocrite. The former political detainees in the PAP, meanwhile, had emerged from detention with a fresh perspective. They realized just how crucial detention without trial is. Their detentions in 1956 and 57 had frozen Singapore's labor and civil rights movements in its tracks. And they learned a harsh lesson, that no matter what their achievements were or how much support they had from the people of Singapore, the colonial state could use internal security laws to arrest them and freeze all reform and scare anyone else who wanted to make Singapore a better place. Basically, there was an unelected government that could bully and overrule the elected government. Lim Chin Siong concluded, quote, "If there is no real political freedom, there can be no long-term economic development," unquote. You know, the funny thing is, these are almost the exact same words that Sir Stamford Raffles wrote at the founding of Singapore. I'm certain that Lim was not thinking of Raffles when he said it, but somehow he came to the same conclusion. Economic freedom requires personal freedom. So as long as the internal security laws remain controlled by unelected British officials, they would be used to influence Singapore for the benefit of the British electorate, not the Singapore people. So security laws could be used to bully the government into passing, or not passing, laws on the economy, education, or housing, or any human rights. The Singapore government, for example, could decide, okay, we want a new employment law that will raise wages. But the British government might then say, oh no, 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 that would negatively impact the economy in Britain. So then they could threaten to use the internal security laws to arrest the main proponents of the new law by saying they were communist or Marxist or something. So anti-colonialism had to begin with democratic control over the entire government. Economic reform, bread and butter issues, could not begin until the government had democratic control over security. Or, as Lim Chin Siong put it, quote, "In a colony ruled by another country, every issue of the people, whether political stability, economic development, or quality of life, is indivisible with the cause of anti-colonialism. Political rights such as independence, liberty, democracy, and freedom provide the country with the political conditions to improve people's lives and develop the country's economy," unquote. So, his chief priority and those of his colleagues in the anti-colonial left were thus to take internal security laws away from the unelected Internal Security Council, abolish the Internal Security Council, and place these laws under the control of a democratically elected government of Singapore. And over time, over the PAP's first and second years, this became a fundamental division within the PAP. So on the one side, you have the former detainees, the progressive left, who believe that control of internal security by a democratically elected government and not by the unelected Internal Security Council was a fundamental requirement of the government before it could tackle bread and butter issues. Indeed, they were so passionate about this that it would come to partially blind them to the priorities of the people of Singapore. More about that in a future episode. On the other side, Lee Kuan Yew's group, the right wing of the party, although, of course, he himself and his fellow colleagues never stopped insisting that they were left wing. But let's be honest, they were the right wing. And it's no coincidence that not a single member of that group was a former detainee. None of the leaders, the big five, Lee Kuan Yew, Rajaratnam, Toh Chin Chye, Goh Keng Swee, or Ong Pang Boon, had ever been detained. Indeed, in that whole group, there really was only one exception who proves the rule, and that was Devan Nair, who was detained but stuck with Lee throughout the 60s, and whom Lee later, in the 1980s, turned on and destroyed and exiled. Poor Devan Nair, who loved Singapore so much and is today buried in an anonymous corner of Canada, a victim of the same destructive forces that he helped unleash. Over the PAP's first year of government, the progressive left grew increasingly suspicious that Lee was actively blocking the release of political detainees. And he was. Initially, of course, they believed Lee when he said the ISC was blocking the releases, but over time, as releases dwindled, they realized that Lee could not be telling the truth. There was no way. Lee was a master politician. He knew that British rule in Singapore depended on a friendly, cooperative Singapore government. In the wake of Suez, in the wake of all the rebellions, nationalist uprisings that had rocked the British Empire in the late 50s, the British simply could not afford to enforce its will on Singapore. If Lee simply insisted that all detainees had to be released and threatened to resign if he did not get his way, the British would have no choice but to agree. Otherwise, they would look like they were not acting in good faith. They would look like they were not allowing the PAP to operate the new constitution in good faith. And what is more, there was evidence that this was their attitude. Back in 1955, David Marshall had used the tactic, the same tactic of threatening to resign, to force the British into concessions on issues that they felt more strongly about. And in the 1956 London constitutional talks, the British had already agreed to give full control of internal security to Singapore. So the British clearly did not care about keeping the political prisoners in. And even if they did, Lee easily could force them to concede on this issue because they needed a friendly Singapore government, a friendly collaborative Singapore government. And the Federation representative wouldn't have been in a position to judge and anyway could be outvoted. So who was keeping the political prisoners in? Who was keeping the political detainees in? There could only be one explanation. Lee Kuan Yew, the hypocrite, the schemer, the manipulator, the master politician, was lying to all of them. And worse, by enabling an unelected body that was not responsible to Singaporeans to detain Singaporeans without trial, he was perpetuating colonialism. He was, they realized, a colonial running dog. Next week, we begin to see the consequences of this issue. But to conclude today, I want to look at what happened after independence from Britain in 1963 and after separation in 65. After 63, of course, Lee would no longer need to be a hypocrite or a running dog. He would use detention without trial with impunity. And he would also severely restrict the freedom of elections. In his later years and in his autobiography, he would freely admit this. He first argued that he was winning elections and so was absolved by the public. But of course, as I discussed in my special episode on elections, elections in Singapore are not free or fair. And after the 1980s, when it became impossible to say that elections were fair, he would justify detention without trial by arguing that the ends justified the means. Look how prosperous Singapore is, he'd say. It's all justified. But of course, as regular listeners of this podcast know, Singapore was rich well before the PAP. So in the 1990s, Lee argued for Asian values. Human rights and democracy are incompatible with Asian culture, he argued. Which of course would be a big surprise to Sun Yat-sen, or Jose Rizal, or Gandhi, or Sukarno, or indeed, to a young Lee Kuan Yew. Of course, that line was dropped after the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s exposed the extent to which Asian economies were rife with crony capitalism. And today, the most prosperous countries in Asia are South Korea and Japan and Taiwan, which all have free elections and human rights protections. Which brings us all the way back today to terrorism as the excuse. Except today, the bogeyman is not communism, but extremism, religious extremism. Currently, there are around 23 people detained without trial under the Internal Security Act, all allegedly for terrorism. None have been tried in open court for their alleged crimes. The government argues that detention without trial is necessary for combating terrorism. Okay, but the problem is that there is a 70-year history of detention without trial being abused by Singapore's government to further their own political aims. By the British in the 1940s, by the British and Lim Yew Hock in the 1950s, by Lee Kuan Yew in the 60s, 70s and 80s, there is no oversight of the use of the law. There is no appeal against the law. There is no accountability for those who abuse the law. David Marshall and Lim Chin Siong's position in the 50s remains as relevant today as it did back then. If such a law was passed by a democratically elected government, if there is oversight and checks and balances, if such a government which used such a law would then have to face the judgment of the people via free and fair elections, that's fine. That's how a democratic system works. But that's not how things work in Singapore today. And this brings us back to my opening question. What is the nature of colonialism? In the 1950s and 60s, we believed that the ability of a government to arrest, to detain without trial, and to torture, with no oversight, no accountability, no appeal, was colonialism. We believe that the mere existence of such a law, that the threat of this law would undermine and butcher the democratic process, was, as a result, anti-democratic. And so the existence of such a law was perpetuating colonialism. Today, we still have a government that can arrest and detain without trial and torture, with no oversight, no accountability, no appeal. The law still exists. And the threat of the law still undermines our democratic process. Are we then still governed as a colonial country? In substance, if not in form? Do we still suffer under colonialism? I leave you with that question. If you'd like to find out more about the use of detention without trial against the people of Singapore, I recommend the documentary 1987, Untracing the Conspiracy, now screening at the projector at Golden Mile Tower in Singapore. A link is in the show notes and at thehistoryofsingapore.com. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.